Hello and welcome to the Ukrainian Improvcast, a series of conversations providing Western listeners with the background, context, and history to understand Russia's war on Ukraine. I'm Sam Bach, and with me as always is my co-host Michael Williamson, and joining us today is Peter Cribley. Peter is a communications consultant and Western entrepreneur in Ukraine, and you can follow his work at luckypupil.co.uk. And today's discussion is going to be focused around the claim that Ukraine is a far-right, neo-Nazi-led state, a claim that Putin used as part of the predicate for his invasion of the country. So we'll be discussing the veracity of this as well as other topics today. A quick disclaimer for our Ukrainian listeners, obviously we understand that this is a sensitive topic, but we are of the mind on this show that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and the best way to dispute these claims is to tackle them head on and discuss areas that might otherwise be sensitive. We understand that in the Ukrainian context, this discussion can sometimes be seen as providing cover for Russian disinformation, but it's incumbent on us to present the full and accurate picture as best we can. So without further ado, let's jump right into it. Peter.
Yeah, thanks. And I also want to expand on what you said when you're talking about sunlight being the best disinfectant. One of the worst things that can be done in this situation is to misunderstand that this is a complex sort of set of interplaying forces, and that if we ignore them or if we deny the reality on the ground, then we feed into Russian propaganda. We give people, useful idiots, the option to say, well, you know, this is what was denied, but actually here's this proof of something that I've got. I've seen this or I've heard of that, without understanding the context for what's going on or how these forces have interplayed. And I hope by the end of the podcast, we'll have determined or maybe agree that they have been spent to a certain extent, that a lot of these right-wing elements were being taken in hand, certainly in 2021, and were becoming less and less of an issue, but also how different criticisms exist from different ways Ukraine has handled these things. With all of that said, first point of all, and I mentioned this to Mike just before we started, there's an excellent, excellent academic called Kamil Galiev. He works with the Wilson Center in Moscow. We've both been following his analysis. He talks about the denazification project, and it's an excellent explanation of how the Russian perception of what it means to be a Nazi is at odds with the Western perception of what it would mean to be a Nazi. The way I would separate that out too, so when we're talking about this Russian denazification, this different portrayal or image there, what Galiev says, and what can be borne out by just looking at the evidence, is that for Russia, this concept is that anything that is not within the Russian sphere of influence or the Russification of a place was considered Nazi. Any fracturing of that identity that was being built as an empire, you know, with the Russian Empire, but obviously that's pre-formal Nazism, the Soviet Empire and Russia's sphere of influence afterwards in the CIS, was seen as or labeled as Nazi just because it was dissent. So smaller identities that didn't conform to this Russification, any means of trying to break it down or separate away from it would get tarnished with this brush of being a Nazi force.
So I know we've prefaced this as sort of a response to what the Kremlin has been putting out regarding the allegations of Nazism and far-rightism in Ukraine. It's worth mentioning, half of the motivation for me wanting to start this project was listening to pundits like Tucker Carlson on TV saying, or echoing very similar things. Like, this propaganda has infiltrated its way into much of Western audiences. And, you know, when people see images, you know, undoctored images of Ukrainian soldiers with, you know, weird patches on their uniforms or even swastika tattoos, it leads them to think that maybe we're the ones being lied to.
So I wanted to get to that actually first, because Mike brought it up, and I think that is important to help our listeners understand. Again, Mike said it great. You do see images coming out that to the Western audience would rightfully raise alarm. So Peter, again, you've spent the most extensive time in Ukraine. I wanted you, and we were talking a little bit about this before the show, I kind of wanted you to just give a rundown, paint a picture to our Western listeners what it actually is like and how pervasive and widespread any of this symbolism, you know, euphemisms, turn of phrase, all that sort of stuff is within Ukraine.
If I could also frame this a little bit more deeply, who exactly are they pointing to? What are the groups and what are they doing? Why is this a problem in the first place?
Yeah, totally. And I can talk more about the groups that I've personally encountered. I obviously can't talk about the people I know within them and who have, you know, spoken to me. That would not be safe for them. But I can talk about experiences encountering these groups and how they are perceived in Ukraine and elsewhere, and how this current war is creating a media landscape where some people are getting outsized voices. The point there being the most well-known of these ones, the one that always gets used to talk about Ukraine, the Azov Battalion, right? If we talk about symbology and we talk about representation, you know, the Azov Battalion really punch way above their weight in the media sphere. So before we even get into anything about how they portray themselves or what they believe, and personally, I find Nazi beliefs completely repulsive, we need to look at what's happening. Yeah. Right now, we need to look at what's happening right now on the ground. An example that came out just this week that I noticed was that a lot of media footage being captured from soldiers in Ukraine was being broadcast or released with Azov watermarked onto it, coming from theaters of battle that Azov was nowhere near. You know, these were not areas where Azov was necessarily involved. So what does this say? What can we take from this? Well, what this allows us to understand, if you know the context, is that Azov are incredibly media savvy. And they are the link for releasing a lot of the non-Azov-related or non-battalion-related footage into Western media hands. And of course,
so to take a step back, hold that thought for just a second, because I want to take a step back. And I think a lot of our listeners might not know what the Azov Battalion even is. The, you know, for instance, the name refers to the geographical location, the seat of Azov. Mm-hmm. So let's take a step back. Like, who are they? Where did they originate? And why have they risen to prominence?
Yeah. So in terms of what they were, and this is where we're going to start to look into the different responses that Ukraine had to use as a state to think about these groups. The Azov Battalion were very active post-Maidan, and they were one of the volunteer battalions, now a regiment folded into the formal hierarchy of the Ukrainian military, that were, to a certain extent, used politically to fight in the Donbass region. Before this could have escalated into a war, there are a lot of reasons to try and keep it much lower key. And these were one of the many militias, I have to highlight, that were out there taking part in this fighting. Now, they were not necessarily formally part of the armed forces of Ukraine, but for a while, they did receive financial and military support from the government. Not the greatest or most convenient of arrangements for the Ukrainian government, and not one that they were always very comfortable about, especially when certain members of Azov started making political noise or, you know, looking at getting involved in things electorally. So if we take that as one example, they have been officially folded in, and we hear a lot of criticism. I personally have been listening to some podcasts and some responses to this that seem to conflict on what they're trying to say here. They say, oh my God, look, so there's an official Nazi battalion, because Azov hold quite right-wing views. And I'll give a personal experience about that in a moment, but they, you know, clearly do. They use a lot of symbology that, again, we'll dig into about the aesthetics in Ukraine of using previous Nazi symbols. But they've been folded in. They're an official integrated regiment. It's awful that Ukraine has a neo-Nazi regiment officially working in the army. While in the same breath, the same people talk about a group called Right Sector, which is a sort of conglomeration of a lot of other members of other battalions and other areas, and just a general mishmash of right-wing actors in Ukraine.
Before we get to that, I do want to really continue to hit on the history of the Azov Battalion.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I think it's really important. No, I think it's really important for our listeners to understand that they were founded, again, right after the wake of the 2014 Maidan and the revolution there. And then also, most importantly, we've glossed over this, like indirectly discussing it, but they were founded as a response to the Russian invasion of Crimea in Ukraine. And that's really important to understand. Yeah, I mean, that's like, you know, you cannot hit that point hard enough, because
there was essentially no functional Ukrainian military. I mean, it was there, but it was in
couple
shambles.
A couple of thousand guys, basically, with any experience.
Like, One piece of context that gets left out when people discuss the Azov Battalion is, yes, there are legitimate Nazis within the ranks. If you trust their self-reporting, they only total about 10 to 20%. We can get into how accurate those numbers might be later.
Which is already too high, to be fair.
Right, but a lot of people who joined these battalions, you know, Azov not being the only one, of course, they joined these battalions because they were kind of your best bet for survival if you were going to go and fight. They were a relatively easy avenue through which to resist the Russians. And, you know, the Ukrainian military was horribly undersupplied, poorly equipped. As far as I know, a lot of times people would go without getting paid. Yeah. It was not the force. Like, do not mix the force from 2014 with the one that's actually holding the Russians at bay today. It is a fundamentally different organization. And so I just want people to keep that in mind going forward. Like, it's easy for us to say that, or it's easy for us to, you know, condemn the Ukrainians for allowing these people to go and fight on their behalf, but they were in a very desperate position, right? Like fighting for their very lives at the time. So they were kind of in a position where they're going to take whatever help that they could get. Again, I'm just trying to explain without condemning or condoning.
Right.
Yes. It's really like, I'm sorry to interject so much, but it's really important to just highlight that point, really drive it home. It's like, if your house was on fire, you're not going to do a background check on the fireman who's coming to put it out. And Ukraine, in 2014, was literally, much like it was today, literally being invaded. There was an active shooting war going on. And if someone shows up, you know, to your defense, you're not going to look too hard at that individual or group of individuals.
And that, unfortunately, is where Ukraine started to run into problems in terms of Nazism and neo-Nazism as a threat to state security, because these people weren't being vetted. And with that in mind, we will also start to unpack how some of these groups, various groups, including members of Right Sector, including former members of Azov, have ties to international neo-Nazi movements, including in Russia. So again, this is a complex, layered combination of forces.
There's some things that are flowing through my head right now regarding the wider far-right movement in Europe, and like comparing it and contrasting to Ukraine, I think you come up with some really interesting points here. The far-right's been on the march in every European country, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, for the last, 10 or 15 years. You see it all over Poland and Hungary and whatever people want to bring up. The difference is in countries like Germany, for example, like Combat 18 is illegal. Like you can't be an open Nazi in these countries, as far as I'm aware. And in Ukraine, it's sort of tacitly not, like you're not going to get thrown in jail. No one's going to silence you from speaking. And yet at the same time, like by numbers of polls, not Polish people. I mean,
going by the poll numbers.
We'll get to that later too. If you go by poll numbers, like self-reporting, Ukrainians report far lower a percentage of far right or Nazi beliefs than you find in other countries. Also, like we keep highlighting, you know, the support that Right Sector, National Core, Svoboda, that all these parties got. They all joined forces for the 2019 election and got barely 2% of the vote nationwide.
They got wiped out, yeah.
Okay, so like there is a Ukrainian parliament. There are 450 people in that parliament. One of them is from these groups. That's one out of 450.
Do want to only draw one disagreement with you there, Mike, and that is that officially within Ukraine, symbols of totalitarianism are illegal. So that should apply equally to Nazi symbols as it does to the symbols of Soviet occupation. Both are supposed to be illegal.
Well, based off the architecture that I saw in Kharkiv, I'd say that those rules are enforced quite loosely.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and those might have been load-bearing hammers and sickles on some of those buildings. but with that in mind...
Well, they could have taken the spotlights, the literal spotlights off of them at night.
Yeah, yeah. But if we get into... Yeah, you mentioned a host of groups there as well, and we can start talking about the ones that... Personally, I've encountered the ones I know about or that I've seen in action. And when you mention Azov, I too... So 2 points on that I want to draw. In the wider international sphere, we're talking about problems in other countries. You've got to look to Russia where you see Wagner, literally called Wagner. Yeah, 6,000 combat-trained members, tacitly endorsed by the Russian Federation.
Let's dig into that one a bit more. Wagner, Mike has a lot to say.
Okay. So for those of you from America who were following the Iraq War back in the day, you might be familiar with a little private military company called Blackwater, and, you know, the not so nice things that they were involved with doing. Russia's equivalent of the Blackwater private military company is this group called Wagner. The Wagner group are extremely active in Syria, have been active in the Central African Republic. All, like, Russia's definitely active in Africa. We don't really talk about that, but they're there. It's why that video on Instagram came out the other day, but I digress. They are almost certain, I can guarantee you they're in Ukraine. I haven't seen a video, but I'm sure they're in Ukraine too. Dmitry Utkin, who is the head of the Wagner group, has an SS tattoo on his neck, straight up. He is, look this guy up, he's the definition of a skinhead when you look at him. Not only does he have the SS tattoo and the bald head and he runs the Wagner group, this dude received basically the equivalent of the Russian Medal of Honor from Putin. There's, like, I forget what the exact name of the award is. It's something like, if you accrue four of these, you can basically convert it into the Medal of Honor. And this dude has four. And I don't think that they've officially converted it, but he has four. So, you know, Putin has not thrown him out.
Yeah. And then, so there's Wagner, which are the military arm, and we can talk about private military companies there, compared to companies being folded into the Ukrainian armed forces. But then in Russia and around Europe, there are this biker group called the Night Wolves, who claim to have 7,000 members and who espouse, you know, the equivalent of 3% of views. But they are, in Putin's words, good friends of his. And they were active in anti-Maidan fight back, you know. So if we look at numbers, as a pure numbers game, the Azov battalion number between 600 to 1,000. Those are the claims. I mean, hard to get accurate numbers, but certainly those are our estimates. There are 6,000 members of Wagner, potentially, maybe more, 7,000 Night Wolves. I mean, a fraction, population-wise, by comparison. And that's Russia alone. Now, when we talk about elsewhere, and we talk about other groups, you know, there are other groups aside from Azov. And in my experience, if we talked about Avakov, which Mike picked up on exactly there, you kind of see the model or the pattern for this, which is less about Nazism and more about a strong figure who likes having the support of a group of young men who are ready to enable their political agenda.
That point about a bunch of kids, you know, kind of attached to the glory, I think that's another key element to understand. Mike, you and I, you know, we're listening to the other podcast kind of about this exact same point that, and Peter sort of touched on it with terms of the media savvy, but I think it's important to understand that for a lot of these groups, it is the cool thing to do if you're a Ukrainian youth, male especially, but the way that these, you know, less than savory groups, the Azov Battalion, et cetera, have been able to brand themselves and appeal to that popular culture within Ukraine is really kind of worth talking about.
Yeah, there are a few things wrapped into this that I want to discuss. Like, one, like, what kind of person actually goes and joins these types of battalions? Well, you're kind of right. Oftentimes, it's a disaffected young man. There's another discussion to be had here that I think is very important, and that is how exactly are things like the swastikas, how exactly are Nazis themselves really, are they viewed exactly the same? Because in my experience, there is this, like, yes, everyone knows what a Nazi is. They know about the Holocaust. They're not dumb. They know what that is in Ukraine. But there's the secondary element of, you know, the Nazis being the temporary liberators of Ukraine from the Soviet Union. Of course, they turned around and put Slavs on the list of them, of those to be called right afterwards. But like, that alliance didn't last very long. But like, in a lot of people's minds, like, the most anti-Russian thing you can be is a dude with a swastika, in a way. So like, a lot of the times I'd find when people are, you know, shaving their heads or wearing swastikas, it's not because they necessarily espouse Nazi ideology. They just see it as a kind of an anti-Soviet symbol. Also, again, full disclosure, like, yeah, I lived in Kyiv. Yes, I actually did see some swastikas spray painted around every now and then. Within, you know, 24 hours, someone would come and try to paint over it. And then you could tell it was like the same guy doing it every single night. He'd go out and like put another one on. It was like the same exact handwriting, same paint can, same like spread. The majority of people are like, they're smarter than that. They don't view things the way that I necessarily describe them. But I did want to add that caveat.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say as well, though, the reason it's a problem in that terms of the most anti-Russian thing you can be as a Nazi is, as we were saying up top, or rather I was rambling up top, that does play into Putin's propaganda hands, because you are therefore legitimizing this idea that, well, anything that will not be Russified must be Nazi because you are the opposition to the Russification by showing your Nazi credentials or by, you know, using that as a demonstration. And unfortunately, it creates this oppositional force that kind of legitimizes this ridiculous argument that Russia and Putin have put forth about denazifying Ukraine.
So I wanted to hit on the history again a little bit. We discussed this in our first previous podcast, but it is important, again, to really drive home how the Soviets and how the Soviets were seen in Ukraine during their rulership of it, basically. The Holodomor, which, again, wiped out millions of Ukrainians, horrific imprinting event in the Ukrainian consciousness, and Mike was alluding to it, but the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and any individual or group or whatever who was able to stand up to one, again, the Soviets were not nice to the Ukrainians. They were doing their own brand of horrific stuff to them, and anyone who could come around and fight against them, liberate, that sort of thing. It's important to understand, we in the West, you know, particularly in the United States, have never been under the subjugated thumb of another country. We've never had an occupying force on our land controlling us, bossing us around. I mean, other than the British, right, Peter? it's really impossible for us to have a conception of what that would be like. And again, without condoning the associations in Ukraine, it is really important to understand this one point.
Now, unfortunately, the aim of the Nazis and Lebensraum was another imperial force merely substituting in and reversing that flow back west. So it is a dangerous idea in any situation, and it's very easy to fall into it, to always think the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But in those heated moments, you do have snap decisions. And certainly worth remembering, too, there were plenty of Ukrainians fighting to push out the Nazis in terms of percentage of people who suffered and died. The top four actually go Belarus, Ukraine, Poland, and then Russia in terms of the percentage of, I believe, overall population that died in World War II in what they would term the Great Patriotic War, pushing out the Nazi advance. So it's not exactly like every Ukrainian saw the Nazis entering and decided, ah, well, great, these are the guys who are going to push out the Soviet Union, this imperial force. I mean, plenty of people had more nous than that. Plenty of people saw it as opportunism in both directions. And, I mean, Mike, you mentioned Kharkiv, which is suffering terribly right now. And what I keep trying to remind people of, people who are still in Ukraine, people outside of Ukraine, Kharkiv was destroyed on multiple occasions. Within World War II, it was taken by the Nazis, retaken by the Soviets, taken back by the Nazis after heavy shelling, and then essentially torn down by the Soviets in a similar pattern to what they did with a lot of Warsaw by allowing the bombs to fall and not intervening when they came back on through. We're talking total war. So even the people who have believed or supported the Soviet Union at the time, who were Ukrainian, will have watched their own city get destroyed by both forces for different purposes. I mean, this is a difficult and violent situation, and it does breed different myths, different ideas, and different symbology. And I wonder, maybe, unless Mike, you have anywhere to contradict me, we can open up on the aesthetics question when it comes to the symbology there.
No, not particularly. I think you've nailed it. I mean, at some point, I do want to talk about this guy Bandera, because he gets brought up a lot. I mean,
no,
Ukrainians.
Please. No, let's.
Yeah, that's what I was. Yeah, that's actually where I wanted to go. So Mike alluded to it, but I think this talk of history naturally flows into a discussion of Stepan Bandera, who not only looms large in the Ukrainian consciousness, but I think is a excellent individual to kind of explain what we've just been talking about through the lens of a single person. So, Mike, do you want to give us some very brief history about him?
Okay, so Stepan Bandera was a Ukrainian ultranationalist political and military leader who is perhaps most famous for having collaborated briefly with the Nazis during World War II. He is widely known in Ukraine. He is widely known in Russia. In Russia, there are many who refer to the Ukrainians as Banderists. Banderists is a derogatory term that basically means a Nazi. And then in Ukraine, he's actually a very polarizing figure. If you go by polling, he is one of the top three most disliked people in the country, up there with Stalin and Gorbachev. He is, however, I guess, more warmly held in the West, where he's from, which is sort of the seat of Ukrainian nationalism, than he is out in the East, right? So Stepan was one of those first people who really stood up and fought for Ukrainian independence, because the collapse of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires after World War I gave the Ukrainian people their first opportunity to create their own official nation. And they fought viciously to defend it. It didn't last very long because they fell into this quagmire of a war. It was like a Game of Thrones level seven-way conflict almost, with the Polish fighting the Western Ukrainians, then the Central Ukrainians fighting the Red Russians and the White Russians, who were also fighting each other. And then you had the Cossack warlords out in the East and the Black Army, and the Romanians jumped in at one point. So this was a really brutal fight, and Stepan was one of those dudes running through the woods, tying people up to trees and letting them freeze to death overnight, and had a lot of, you know, xenophobic views and ethnic hatred, like, deep in his heart. Yes, that is true. So did everybody else, right? So he was not unique. He was not a sweetheart, but he was not unique. Flash forward to World War II, and yes, the Nazis come through, and they offer Stepan to recreate the Ukrainian nation and give them independence once again, in exchange for collaboration, right? So that's what he does. Now, bear in mind that this was off the back of things like the Holodomor. This was off the back of many, many years of Soviet occupation in Ukraine, where they intentionally flattened the Ukrainian identity and culled their intellectual and artistic elite. So the Soviets were the bad guys that they knew, and the Germans were just this kind of unknown force. It's not clear to me how much Stepan cooperated with the Jewish Holocaust. I know he was primarily concerned with killing Polish people, yet again, his old enemy. And then ultimately, after World War II ended, the guy dies a martyr at the hands of the KGB by assassination. So that probably upped his it probably upped his status a little bit in the eyes of many people. So again, he is only regarded positively by maybe a quarter of the population, probably a bit less, depending on what poll you're looking at. It's between like 8% viewing him strongly positively, and then maybe 25% feeling positive or neutral, and the rest are kind of like, yeah, he was a bad guy. We don't really like him. There were other people doing the same thing, but better. But he is kind of this romantic figure for having been so active in the conflict. It should also be noted that a lot of people who fly that flag, they do so in a way that's more anti-Russian than it is nationalistic or fascistic. You know, we can obviously disagree on that later, but like the whole Bandera movement is, you know, the whole Ukrainian resistance movement was primarily an anti-Soviet, anti-Russian thing, not like an anti-Jewish, let's all be Nazis kind of thing. So one last thought experiment that I want to layer on top of this, I'm going to actually steal this from another podcast by Jocko Willink and Daryl Cooper called The Unraveling. Great show. You guys should check it out. But he put it like this. Imagine Louis Farrakhan in the United States, who is like this famous civil rights activist who also happens to hold a lot of anti-Semitic views that he's been widely condemned for. But people like Barack Obama, who are also obviously like the civil rights movement's very near and dear to him, they are very reluctant to throw Farrakhan out. Why? Because he was an ally during this fight that was obviously very important, very righteous, and that it's hard to just throw the guy out of hand. And so like the analogy is like, just think of having that crazy uncle who comes over for dinner on Thanksgiving, and it's like, you love him, you've known him for years, you know, he's been there for you through thick and thin, just don't bring up the Jews, right? And I feel like a lot of Ukrainians might be viewing Bandera in a similar light, again, with the extra layer of he was like staunchly anti-Russian, even though he was really more anti-Pole, maybe a bit of both, but yeah, and again, died a martyr, and so that all plays into his image today.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting, too, that he was xenophobic in his beliefs. The Poles, the Russians, extremely, and to a certain extent, Jewish people, too.
Extremely. The only point I'm trying to make is that he was certainly not unique for the time in those kinds of views.
No, not at all. But he was also a pragmatist. So for him, it was whatever will work to serve my goals. Hence why you will hear people, rightly or wrongly, tell stories about how Bandera actually saved some Jewish people. He forged some papers. He helped them get through. And the debate there is whether or not that was out of altruism or whether these were skilled individuals, doctors, for example, who could help aid his cause. So there is an ultimate thread of pragmatism running through this entire life, ruthless pragmatism, on top of a layer of thick xenophobia, mostly against Poles and Russians, but also, as with many people at the time, I mean, including members of the British and American High Command, anti-Semitism. You know, this was not unheard of outside of Nazi Germany, but certainly for other people of a different breed or of a different belief or of a different intensity. In his collaborationist activities, thoroughly repulsive as they are, we also need to bear in mind, when you talk about support for him, a recent kind of very terminally online trend has been the ironic veneration of Bandera. So Russians saying, well, you Ukrainians, you're all Nazis. And younger people going, well, if you say I'm a Nazi who loves Bandera, I'm a Banderite, I'm going to start singing pro-Bandera songs, not to prove you right, because obviously this is not something I believe in. I'm talking about members of the LGBT community within Ukraine, you know, minorities within Ukraine going, yeah, all right, I'm pro-Bandera. If that's what you say about me, that's what I'm going to be. In an ironic way to, if not strike back, then at least try and recontextualize this, as you pointed out, Mike, very complex and unpleasant legacy. The history of Ukraine, a desperate one of trying to survive and maintain a thread of independence, despite tragedy after tragedy over centuries. And so that does create a breeding ground for different ideologies, but a certain sense of pragmatism. What is it that will allow me to survive?
So I'm going to interject here and sort of shift the conversation just a little bit, because pragmatism, nuance, these are some words that we've been throwing around, and I kind of want to wrap the discussion up by bringing it towards modern day again and discuss some of the contradictions in what we've been discussing with regards to how much far-rightism there is in the country, and then take that versus, for instance, the fact that the president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is Jewish, very openly so, not like, that's not hidden, and the fact that the Azov Battalion is under the Ukrainian National Guard under his leadership. Peter, you know, when we were talking previously, you were discussing, and I don't want to spoil it, but if you could give the example.
There are several restaurants in the Padil district that I will no longer eat in purely because I have clocked people either with just straight-up swastika tattoos or with less obvious ideological ones like the Sonnenrad, which we can discuss later or we can open up for at a different point. But it's essentially a kind of pseudo or crypto-Nazi symbol to try and fly a little bit under the radar, but not so much anymore. It's quite well known. And yet, in this same district, there are synagogues, there are Jewish populations. I will see people going and eating in these restaurants after going to temple, collecting bagels with locks. In a professional context, Ukrainians get along with their lives. They get along with their neighbors and they do their best to. Outside of work, these people may be in danger around each other. And I can give certain anecdotes about how that has certainly happened. But these are neighborhoods where people are living and at the moment dying together. And that has to be remembered, that these are communities of people that work together. We look at Maidan as well. You'll hear stories of Jewish Ukrainians, anarchist Ukrainians, Nazi Ukrainians fighting alongside each other in order to push out the Berkut, for example. Is this a permanent, you know, joining of forces? Of course not. The enemy of my enemy is my friend until the next day when he's just my enemy again, and we have to sort this whole tangled mess out. And after this war, there's going to have to be a lot of mess that's going to need to be untangled. But right now, it's a fight for survival.
Dare I say for the last 8 years, even?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Absolutely. That was completely right. Thank you for correcting me there. It's not just been right now. Right now is total war, but it has been an existential problem for a long time. Flip side of this, which I definitely wanted to get into and wanted to explain, was you mentioned earlier about the percentages, how much of the Azov Battalion are Nazi and how much aren't. And when I first came to Ukraine and I was less knowledgeable about this, I kind of gave them some slack in terms of, well, they're right wing, but absolutely right. People joined because it was your best chance for survival. Still believe that. And then the flip side of that lovely anecdote about people coming together is walking through Freedom Square in Kharkiv, where there is the Everything for Victory tent, and they have a recruitment poster for Azov right there. And looking at the symbol and understanding that you can basically just buy phone numbers off the shelf in Ukraine. If you want a phone number, it's yours. You just pay someone for it. They have 1488 right there in the middle.
Yeah.
And you have
for listeners who are unaware, Google it, and it's a very clear reference to Hail Hitler. So
yeah, we don't have to get into it.
Yeah, we don't have to get into it, but that's a deliberate, you know, Peter saying that's a very deliberate decision on their part.
Yeah, it is not subtle. And then I had to sort of readjust my attitude there and go, well, there has to be, considering they're so media savvy, there has to be enough people that whose hands that's gone through who have given that the okay. Or enough people who are like, yeah, that's fine by me. So again, there is a flip side to this.
This isn't about like where I want to see Ukraine go. This is about where it is right now. And yeah, the fact that this is a lot more complex and nuanced than simply looking at, oh, there's a sonogram or whatever you call it, or a swastika, and I know exactly what that means because I read a history book, when it's actually, you know, not necessarily viewed the same way by all these people.
So we've been discussing a lot about the nuances of what's going on in Ukraine in this episode. It's important to be able to show and to explain to our listeners that what some folks have seen on the news regarding questionable patches on quasi-military uniforms, for instance, isn't just a fabrication. There really is some there. However, at the same time, we hope that we've been able to provide some background and context that helps us show how much of a wild and unjustified oversimplification the Kremlin's claims of Ukraine being a Nazi-led regime are. So with that, let's take it home. Mike, you first, and then Peter.
Sure. I mean, just to sort of repackage most of what I said, is there a far-right and Nazi issue in Ukraine? Yes, if you're just going by the numbers. Again, they get a lesser share of the vote than they do in a lot of other countries. Actually, like if you look at a map of where the far-right got their votes, the nationalist parties, Ukraine has by far the lowest percentage in Europe. Now, whether you can draw pure equivalencies between those groups, that's really beyond my ability to say. But the, you know, the reality of these accusations is always more complicated than the narratives that you hear on the news.
Certainly, and just to piggyback off what Mike said there, not to resort to whataboutism, which is a very Russian rhetorical technique, but when we talk about neo-Nazis, the issue is that they are a global force. We could have an entire podcast about the links worldwide that make this a problem for Ukraine, but where would we draw the line? A lot of these groups grew out of ultras and football hooligans. Would you call the football hooligans of the UK, especially the ones who espouse far-right beliefs, neo-Nazis? Some, not all. Would you say the same for countries like the US or Germany, which have a huge number of, well, comparative to Ukraine, of neo-Nazis within them? Would you call them neo-Nazi countries? No, of course not. And the same is true of Ukraine.
So with that, we wanted to thank our listeners again for tuning in to the second episode of the Ukrainian Provcast, and say thank you again to Peter for joining us. Once again, you can follow Peter's work at luckypupil.co.uk. Mike and I will be back again very soon with another episode of the Ukrainian Provcast, but until then, keep up the fight. The Ukrainian Provcast is co-hosted by Sam Bach and Michael Williamson. Audio production by Mark Fusito. Artwork by Eli Bach.